This is ESPN Radio.
Kenny and Golic Jr. on ESPN Radio and ESPN Plus. Amber Wilson filling in for Mike Golic Jr. Chris Canty. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests appear via the Goodyear Hotline. Tweet us on the Dr. Pepper Twitter line at AmberW790, at ChrisCanty99. We want to hear from you about which team is least likely to make it to the college football playoff. And the four teams that are currently in right now, Bama, Georgia, Michigan, and Cincy. And that's a part of the ESPN Radio Twitter poll that we put up for Canty and Golic Jr., the weekend preview poll. And so you can chime in on Twitter as well. This weekend preview is brought to you by Geico. Whether you rent or own, Geico makes it easy to bundle home and car insurance. Go to geico.com. And Amber, we started this conversation earlier today with Chris Doering, ESPN SEC analyst, and he seemed to think that it was going to be next to impossible to have a two-loss Alabama team that wouldn't be a conference champion to stay in the top four when it came to the final rankings from the College Football Playoff Selection Committee. So do you fall on that crew, or do you think there is a possibility that Alabama, even if they lose to Georgia in the SEC championship game, can get in?
No, because under all of these scenarios, for the most part, they'd have to be jumping some team or multiple teams sitting at, you know, 11-1 or 12-1. And it's really hard for me to believe that the committee would push a two-loss Alabama team above, you know, any one-loss team. And then obviously we have the Cincinnati factor of this conversation as well. It's hard for me to believe that Alabama is going to win this game. It's Nick Saban. I'm never going to completely count him out. It's like, you know, there's certain dudes like a Tom Brady, you know, even maybe a Bill Belichick. Like, there's certain guys that you don't necessarily want to put your money against. I'm not necessarily going to put my life savings on the fact that Georgia's going to win this game because Nick Saban's on the other side of that. But this Bama team does feel like the Bama team with the most cracks in it that we've seen in recent memory. And this Georgia team, as you and I discussed earlier, certainly does not have any, at least on the defensive side of the ball. And if Georgia wins this game, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because that can mean more chaos. Like, if you're rooting for all the chaos, that doesn't necessarily mean rooting for the upset here, because if Bama beats Georgia, then Georgia and Bama are getting in, right? And that's not necessarily the most chaotic situation. Like, most of the most craziest situations still can occur if Georgia beats Alabama, but I don't think any of those situations involve a two-loss Bama team getting in.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think if Alabama loses to Georgia, even if it's a close game, closer than the experts expect, I think Alabama still gets bounced from the top four just because of what's behind Cincinnati. I mean, you've got a one-loss Notre Dame team, and you've got Oklahoma State sitting there at the fifth spot. And if they beat Baylor, who's also ranked in the top 10 in the college football playoff rankings, then that's another quality win that's on their resume as well. So they undoubtedly will jump in. As a matter of fact, I think this is a playoff situation for Oklahoma State. If they beat Baylor, they are in the college football playoff, period. There is no ifs, ands, buts about it. So I'm looking at that, and I guess the question would be what happens to Cincinnati.
If they beat Baylor and Georgia beats Bama, right? Because then that situation gets confused if Bama does beat Georgia. And then Cincinnati wins, then does OK State get in? Because you have to make room for Bama in that situation. Like, there's so many scenarios. I pulled like 15 scenarios that can happen. There's still so many scenarios that can happen with these computer models. As many scenarios as there are that can happen, like, it only really realistically feels like a couple could happen.
Yeah, the one I will say that is likely, though, if Oklahoma State wins, Oklahoma State is going to get in. And if Alabama pulls up the upset against Georgia, then Cincinnati's going to be out of the college football playoff. And everybody that was rooting for a group of five team to actually make it, they're going to be disappointed, because it's just not going to happen. I don't think Cincinnati is going to have enough quality wins, even though they would have beaten Notre Dame, who is currently ranked sixth, and they would have beaten Houston in the AAC championship game, and they're ranked 21st. I just don't see that happening, given Oklahoma State's resume and the quality wins that they have. So that's the one thing I will say. A one-loss OK State team
will jump a no-loss Cincinnati team in that scenario.
Yes.
That's what you feel confident in. And you may be right. I don't know what the reaction to that is going to be, because I do feel like people generally want Cincinnati in the playoff picture. It's going to be maybe bad for the group of five if they get in and then they just get absolutely mutilated in the first round of these playoffs. But I do think that the majority of the country is probably rooting to see Cincinnati get that opportunity.
Yeah, everybody's probably rooting for Cincinnati. I don't think there's anybody that's rooting. I will say it this way. Let me frame it this way. Right now, when it comes to the teams that I absolutely want to see in that are right there, I want to see Notre Dame get into the college football playoff. I just do. Just based on what happened to them this week with their head coach deciding that he was going to leave, even though there was the slimmest of chances that they could potentially make the playoff, I didn't like it for those kids because it feels like it puts them at a disadvantage. And you heard Gary Barta come out after this latest release of the rankings on Tuesday and say that coaches and players that could potentially be out are going to be factored in the final selection process. So I didn't want those kids in that locker room for Notre Dame to have something like that weigh against them, something that they have no control over. And so for the Notre Dame administration to act the way that they did and to retain Marcus Freeman and most of the staff there at Notre Dame, I feel like that's one of those things that the committee, they might look at, but they'll give them the benefit of the doubt because of continuity. So in all of this, I'm rooting for chaos because I'm rooting for Notre Dame to get in. And I know somewhere in Texas, Mike Golick Jr. is smiling that I'm actually saying that. But I feel like there's a lot of people around the country that want to see the Irish get in a way that we've never really felt before. Because when it comes to the college football playoff, nobody usually wants to see Notre Dame get in. But I feel like everybody is rooting for this group for that specific reason.
Well, and if Brian Kelly hadn't left, I don't know if any of us would be rooting for Notre Dame to get in again. But
exactly.
I agree with you that there probably are a lot of people rooting for the chaos. This is a rare season where I'm actually not rooting for the chaos because normally I'm all about chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel like Georgia so deserves to beat Alabama and to make its way in and to finally get over that hump. You know, like I will feel good for Georgia in that moment and Kirby's team because it's just been such a difficult run for a very good Georgia team that's been good for a while now. I love the idea of Cincinnati beating Houston and actually getting in because I love the idea of seeing a group of five. I love the idea of Michigan beating Iowa and getting it done and not falling off after beating Ohio State and actually going according to plan for that team once. So I'm actually not rooting for the chaos. Like I think I'm actually rooting for these conference championships to go according to plan. I'm not nearly as passionate about OK State and Baylor, but that one I also expect to go according to plan.
Yeah, so basically what you laid out, you expect to see Georgia, Michigan, Oklahoma State, and Cincinnati as the final four in the college football playoff field. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't think the committee would put Notre Dame in ahead of Oklahoma State, and I do not believe the committee would put in a two-loss Alabama team ahead of either of those two teams.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think that's probably the most likeliest of scenarios. But for everybody that was rooting for a group of five team in Cincinnati to get in, your prize, the Georgia Bulldogs. And it's felt like pretty much all season that it's Georgia and everybody else when it comes to who's going to win the national championship. I think if you posed that question to a lot of people a couple of weeks ago, they would have probably said, yeah, I'll take Georgia over the field. They're just that good. Coming up next, how does Daniel Jones' absence impact the Giants, and can Tua show enough to prove he's the long-term answer for the Dolphins at quarterback? We'll tell you. This is Chris Canty and Amber Wilson filling in for Mike Golick Jr. on Canty and Golick Jr. on ESPN Radio.
This is ESPN Radio.
Canty and Golick Jr. on ESPN Radio and ESPN app. Amber Wilson filling in for Mike Golick Jr., Chris Canty. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests appear via the Goodyear Hotline. And Amber, I knew I was due for one of those today just because I'm so used to saying Mike Golick Jr., but he's somewhere out in Texas getting ready for the Dr. Pepper Challenge and that Big 12 championship game. But we got a game that both of us are very familiar with coming up in Week 13 on the NFL slate. Two teams that we've both been a part of in different capacities. Your Miami Dolphins and my New York Football Giants, and we got the news today that Daniel Jones is going to miss this game, and in steps Mike Glennon for Daniel Jones. Daniel Jones still dealing with a neck injury that he suffered in the win against the Philadelphia Eagles in Week 12. And so now the Giants are going to start a quarterback that hasn't had his last win as a starter since 2017. And since then, I want to say he's 0-5 as a starter. So not a great track record for the Giants quarterback going down to Florida against a defense, against a team that's getting pretty hot right about now.
Yeah, the last time we saw him, he was 16 of 25, 196 yards, one touchdown, two interceptions. Mike Glennon is not who you want to see under center for your New York Giants. I don't know if you want to see Daniel Jones. There's a lot of controversy surrounding that subject, but I don't think that there's much controversy surrounding Mike Glennon. I don't think anybody wants to see him starting for this New York Giants team against a defense in the Miami Dolphins that was supposed to be a very, very good defense coming into the season. That was really, really confusing how they started the season. But of late, you've seen them completely turn things around and gain that identity that we thought that they were going to have at the beginning of the season. This is the rare time, though, Chris, where you and I get to talk Dolphins-Giants multiple times during this show. It's not often that we discuss over and over again a 5-7 versus a 4-7 preview. But that, frankly, is the importance of Daniel Jones to this New York Giants team, even if we are completely unclear about his future. And even if, you know, there's a lot of differing opinions about whether he should remain part of this organization moving forward, that doesn't apply to this season. Like, nobody's vying for you to sit Daniel Jones in order to start Mike Glennon right now. And the problem with this for Jones is that there are all those questions. Like, how do you think this impacts his future with the Giants? Because now it's just another situation where he's not available and there's more questions and there's less time to kind of evaluate him and make decisions based on him.
Well, that's the thing, Amber. I mean, this is another opportunity that he's going to miss to be able to evaluate him. And with Daniel Jones, this was all about trying to figure out whether or not he's the franchise guy. That was the goal of this season, similar to what the New York Jets just went through last year with Sam Darnold. I mean, this is getting to the point where the Giants are going to have to make a decision on Daniel Jones' fifth-year option coming up in 2022, and you're talking about a fifth-year option that's going to pay him in the ballpark of $20 million. So the last thing you want to do as an organization is be on the hook for that salary in the 2023 season, knowing that he's not going to be your guy. And so that's the biggest thing with Daniel Jones. You want opportunities to be able to evaluate him. So on top of him turning the ball over at this rate that he has, we're talking about a player that has two more total touchdowns than he does turnovers. I want to say it's 59 total touchdowns to 49 total turnovers. Not exactly what you're looking for a player in year three, but the other thing that you're not looking for is for the guy to miss time in each of his first three seasons as the starting quarterback. So, again, the Giants got to make a determination who they want to hitch their wagon to, and this is a franchise that's going to have two picks that are in the top 10 of this year's NFL draft because they own the Chicago Bears first-round pick from the Justin Fields draft day trade. And right now, if the draft were today, you were talking about the Giants being able to hold the number 6 and the number 7 overall pick. So a huge decision that the general manager for the Giants is going to have to make on Daniel Jones' future. And now, because he's going to be out this game, you're missing that opportunity. So, again, this is a big deal for the New York Giants in trying to determine what their future is at the quarterback spot. But I also think this is a big deal. This is a big game for the Miami Dolphins in trying to determine what they're going to do at the quarterback spot because the Deshaun Watson rumors aren't going away. And the question that I have for you, Amber, is can Tua show enough in the final six games or final five games to sway the Dolphins and to convince them that they shouldn't go after Deshaun Watson?
Those rumors aren't ever completely going away until Deshaun Watson ends up on somebody else's roster. Like, that's finally when the rumors will stop. Or maybe he ends up on the Miami Dolphins roster. I'm not saying that's out of the realm of possibility. I'm just saying that these rumors otherwise are going to continue until that time. Now, they've quieted down a whole lot since the trade deadline, obviously, because now nothing can happen until the offseason. The problem is that when we talk about Tua and Deshaun Watson in the same sentence, we're comparing Tua to a dude who's arguably a top five quarterback in the NFL and Deshaun Watson, certainly a top 10 on everybody's list in Deshaun Watson. And I don't know if that's fully fair to Tua. If you and I were having the conversation, like you just mentioned the Giants draft picks, they have multiple top 10 draft picks if everything stopped today and the draft was held. And it may end up panning out like that for the end of the season for your New York Giants. So then their evaluation is looking at the quarterbacks in this draft, which is not a very good quarterback draft, but nevertheless, if you have that kind of draft capital, could you trade them away, you know, and get somebody else? And, you know, maybe that that's going to help you in a situation with a Daniel Jones who you're not sold on. With Tua, though, the evaluation, if we're talking about that sort of thing, then I would say absolutely. Tua could do enough to shape that narrative and get the Dolphins to look a different direction and not necessarily look towards the draft or look towards trading picks for somebody else. But if we're talking about Deshaun Watson, now that conversation gets a lot more complicated because now we're talking about an elite NFL quarterback. You know, we're not just talking about, you know, bringing in some dude who might end up being good for the Dolphins. We don't have Tua might end up being really good for the Dolphins. There's question marks either way. There's no question marks with Deshaun Watson. And that's the problem for as long as these rumors hang over the head of Tua Tagovailoa. And you've already seen this season, like they start out the season 1-7. It's nothing but Deshaun Watson rumors. And look at them now on this 4-game win streak. I think they're going to get a win on against the Giants. This is a very winnable schedule on the way out here for the Miami Dolphins. They've completely turned their season around. And let's not pretend like some of that might have something to do with the trade deadline passing and those rumors going away. And all of a sudden, Tua is playing much, much better.
Yeah, there's no question about it. That's a tough position for a player to be in, especially a guy in his second year that's had injury concerns. Hearing that you could be potentially supplanted by your team making a blockbuster trade for a quarterback that's considered elite in the eyes of most. So I'm with you on that one, and I'm also with you in terms of Tua not necessarily having enough time to be able to completely dispel the Deshaun Watson rumors and get rid of that, because I don't think there's anything that he can do in the next 5 games that's going to get that to completely go away. That will be there, but I do think there is an opportunity for him to try to show the Miami brass that the opportunity cost might not be worth it for Deshaun Watson, given what Tua is bringing to the table. I think the best thing that he can do is try to close the gap in terms of what the Dolphins are looking for in quarterback play and allow them to think about the resources that it would take to bring over Deshaun Watson in a trade and how they can be reallocated to improve the supporting cast around the quarterback. Because Lord knows that offensive line for the Dolphins is porous, to say the least.
We're not very good at drafting, though.
Pretty bad. They're not going to draft any of that. Jalen Waddle looks pretty good, though. We got to say that.
Waddle looks like a very good pick. Jalen Waddle does look pretty good. I loved his waddling celebration, by the way.
You got that one right. You got that one right. But coming up next, we'll try to get it right when we're talking about the 6-win AFC teams that needs the Week 13 win the most. 6-win AFC teams that needs the Week 13 win the most. You're listening to Kenny and Golic Jr., Amber Wilson filling in for Mike Golic Jr., ESPN Radio, ESPN Plus.
This is ESPN Radio.
Ball Friday here on Kenny and Golic Jr. on ESPN Radio and ESPN Plus. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests appear via the Goodyear Hotline. ESPN is presented by Progressive Insurance. Save when you bundle auto, home, or motorcycle insurance. Visit progressive.com. And Amber, Week 13 in the NFL got kicked off last night with the Cowboys beating the Saints 27-17, but it got us to looking at the rest of the slate on Sunday. And in the AFC in particular, you have a closely contested playoff field. There are currently 5 6-win teams in the AFC, with one of those teams in the Los Angeles Chargers holding on to a wild card spot, that seventh playoff spot in the conference. And so of the five 6-win playoff teams, we've got the Cleveland Browns, who are actually on their bye week. We've got the Indianapolis Colts at 6-6. And then we've got the LA Chargers at 6-5, the Denver Broncos at 6-5, and the Las Vegas Raiders at 6-5. So we've got 4 of those 5 6-win teams in the AFC in action this weekend. And I'm just going to run down the games that they're in. The Chargers are taking on the Bengals in Cincinnati. We've got the Colts taking on the Texans in Houston. We've got the Raiders hosting the Washington football team. And then the Denver Broncos travel into Arrowhead to take on the Chiefs. So of those four teams that have 6 wins in the AFC, which team would you say needs a win the most in Week 13?
Well, it's easy, I think, to pinpoint the Colts as having the easiest matchup this week. If you look at the rest of the schedule, though, things do not get very easy for the Indianapolis Colts. So they obviously need to take care of business against a team that they can take care of business. But you mentioned the Chargers there. And of course, the Chargers, a big matchup against the Bengals. We talked about it extensively. The Justin Herbert, Joe Burrow showdown, even if they don't directly play against each other. There's a lot of questions there that are going to be answered because those quarterbacks are so, so close in terms of all of their statistics and obviously coming out of the same draft class. I think the Chargers, because you mentioned that wild card position that they're currently in, they probably need this win. The reason that I'm saying they need it the most is frankly because I think the Chargers and the Colts are going to end up being neck and neck in terms of trying to make the playoffs. I don't really have any belief here in the Broncos, the Raiders, and the Browns. I mean, listen, the good news for Cleveland fans is you can't lose on a bye week. So that's the good news there. But with the Broncos and the Raiders, I understand they're coming off of wins. And with the Raiders, obviously, you were just in a position, what was it, like 2 weeks ago? We were talking about, you know, a three-game skid with the Raiders and their season was over. And man, how the mighty had fallen. And then they go and they get a win on Thanksgiving over the Dallas Cowboys. It has turned everything around statistically for them. The problem was that Dallas was undermanned and super banged up in that game. It was Thanksgiving. Weird things happen on Thanksgiving. People really mm-hmm. want turkey. They're hungry, you know? And so Dallas wasn't at full strength, and it was an overtime win. I, as much as I credit Derek Carr for what he has been able to do with keeping that team on track during an unbelievably difficult season off the field for the Raiders, I do not believe in the Raiders here moving forward, and I don't believe in the Broncos either, frankly. So this one, to me, comes down to the Chargers and the Colts.
Amber, I'm still laughing because you said the tryptophan tripped up the Dallas Cowboys on Turkey Day. I'm still laughing at that one. But you're right. I don't think the Raiders are going to be a live dog in this AFC playoff picture. Neither do I buy into the Denver Broncos with Teddy Two Gloves. But I do think we have to look closely at the Colts and at the Chargers because that last playoff seed in the AFC is going to come down to those two teams. And if you're the Colts, you invested heavily in being able to bring over Carson Wentz from the Philadelphia Eagles to be your starting quarterback. And if he finishes off the season, you're talking about having to ship a first-round draft pick over to the Philadelphia Eagles for your quarterback. It would be a shame that the Indianapolis Colts wouldn't be able to find themselves at least in the same spot that they were in last year, which is the wild card round in Buffalo, and that game was closely contested against the Bills. They were a goal-to-goal sequence away from being able to win that game. But, I mean, if you're the Colts team, knowing what you've got invested in Carson Wentz in this group, if you were to somehow be on the outside looking into the playoff picture, then you'd have to consider this season a massive failure. And you're right. They have to beat the Houston Texans. This is a team that's won 5 of their last 7 games, so they're trending in the right direction. But this is ultimately going to come down to making sure that Carson Wentz doesn't have the most inopportune turnovers. That's really what it's all about, right? And we saw that pop up against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I don't imagine that's going to be the case against Houston because they're probably going to lean on that ground game and Jonathan Taylor, as they should. But at some point down the stretch, you're going to have to ask Carson Wentz to make some throws to help you win football games. And I'm not quite sure that he's going to be capable of doing that, at least not to the same level of Justin Herbert. So if we're saying which teams need to have to win the most this weekend, I would probably say the Colts and the Chargers.
It's a toss up. They both need to win. I mean,
you're right. It is a toss up, but I would probably gather to say it has to be the Indianapolis Colts just because I think Justin Herbert gives the Chargers a little more margin for error. So I'm going to agree with you on that one.
Well, and the Chargers, of course, are facing the better team here in terms of opponent as well. Carson Wentz, you mentioned him, and he's really turned things around, though, in credit to Wentz. I mean, 18 passing touchdowns since week 4. That's the second most in the NFL in that time period. I think the big real deal here for the Colts, though, was getting that O-line back together. I mean, in the beginning of the season, we know how injured they were, missing Nelson and Smith and Fisher and getting them back together. And then, of course, obviously, Jonathan Taylor. I mean, if the season ended today and it's week 13, you know, after week 13, if the season ends today, that dude has really, really good stats for a full season. And hey, it doesn't end today. Like, he's still got 4 more chances to do it. That's how good Jonathan Taylor has been for the Indianapolis Colts. That Colts team is really trending the right direction. I might give like a slight edge to the Chargers because they're already in that position, like you mentioned. But both of these teams need to continue to win. I think these are the teams out of these 6-win AFC teams that we'll see in a playoff type scenario.
Yeah, and on the other side of that bye week that the Colts have in week 14, they've got the New England Patriots and the Arizona Cardinals. Mm-hmm. So good luck with that. It just feels like this is one of those situations that the Colts have got to take their wins where they can get them, because I don't know, down the stretch, it feels like they're not going to have a whole lot of margin for error. That's just how I see it on my side of the moon. But we'll see what happens with these matchups this weekend. But, Amber, I think we narrowed it down. Of those 5-6-win teams in the AFC, the two teams that need to get the wins the most, the Colts and the Chargers, and we're giving the slight edge to the Colts just because they have the matchup against the Houston Texans, who is a 2-win team. There's no way they have any business losing to those people. But coming up next, LSU head coach Brian Kelly debuts his new Southern accent. It's Amber Wilson and Chris Canty, Canty and Golic Jr. on ESPN Radio and ESPN Plus. All Friday here on Canty and Golic Jr. on ESPN Radio and ESPN Plus. Amber Wilson filling in for Mike Golic Jr. Chris Canty, we're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests appeared via the Goodyear Hotline. Got to give a shout out to the guests that joined the show today. SEC Network analyst Chris Doran getting us set for the SEC Championship game down in Atlanta between Alabama and Georgia. We had Chris the Bear Felica from Stanford Steve and the Bear podcast. My former teammate, ESPN NFL analyst and co-host of NFL Live, Marcus Spears. And then rapper Waka Flocka Flame. If you missed any of it, go to the Canty and Golic Jr. podcast, download, rate, and subscribe. We'd greatly appreciate it. But Amber, we have now reached the portion of our show where it's time for us to go 3 and out.
Sometimes it's the worst. Sometimes it's the best. Either way, we'll get you straight with everything you need to know. This is 3 and out.
So 3 and out is brought to you by My Computer Career, training for a better life. And Amber, we have to start out with new LSU coach Brian Kelly. So on Wednesday night, he introduced himself to the LSU fans at a home game down in Baton Rouge. And it was a game between Ohio and LSU. And he came out with a little bit of a strange accent. So I'm going to let you gauge this for yourself. And you got to tell me whether this is anything that you've ever heard from Brian Kelly. Here's Brian Kelly introducing himself to the LSU Tiger fans at the home game last evening.
It's a great night to be a Tiger. I'm here with my family, and we are so excited to be in the great state of Louisiana, but more importantly, to be with you great fans and to be part of what is going to be an incredible ride here at Louisiana State University.
Now, Amber, this is a 60-year-old man from the Boston suburb of Everett, Massachusetts, and he spent the vast majority of his coaching career in the Midwest. He was the coach at Grand Valley State, where he won a Division II national championship. He was at Central Michigan and Cincinnati before taking over Notre Dame. And I didn't necessarily hear a Northeastern accent. I didn't hear a Midwest accent. I heard a Deep South accent, and it really came out for me when he said the word family.
Family.
I mean, family. I mean,
there were several words in there.
Syllable to the word. So am I tripping, or is Brian Kelly putting a little bit too much on this as the new head coach of LSU?
Here's what I think happened, because I've been hearing people all day long on our airwaves or making fun of Brian Kelly because nobody just develops a Southern accent overnight. However, I once, very famously amongst my friends, I was in Europe and I was speaking to somebody who was Italian who spoke very little English. Now, there was quite a bit of alcohol involved in this story that I'm telling you, so I'll go ahead and disclose that to you, Chris. But I, in my mind at the time, decided that this person who doesn't speak very good English and didn't understand what I was saying in English would somehow understand me better if I spoke it in a really, really, really terrible Italian accent. And apparently, at some point in the night, because he was hanging out with us all night, I just started speaking in a terrible Italian accent every time I started speaking to him. And my friends thought it was the funniest thing ever. So I think that's what Brian Kelly was doing here, Chris. He was just trying to be one of them and make sure that they could understand him down in Louisiana. They'd been listening to Ed O for so long. You know, they're accustomed to a certain sort of twang. And he was just trying to emulate that, get on their level so that they really absorbed everything he was saying.
So what you're saying is Ed O speaks a different language other than the English language.
Yes.
And that's what LSU fans have become accustomed to. And that's what Brian Kelly was trying to match.
Yes, he was trying to put on the accent so that they would understand. I did learn a valuable lesson, though. Apparently, if you're still speaking English, it doesn't actually help the other person understand, even if you do a terrible rendition of their accent, if you're still actually speaking English and not their language. There's my PSA for the nation tonight. But I do think that's what Brian Kelly was doing. I get it.
Yeah, I don't know if I can get on board with this one, Amber. I mean, the worst thing you can do is fool yourself, and it's kind of patronizing to all of a sudden adopt the Southern accent when we know that you've been the head coach for about 5 minutes and you really haven't spent a whole lot of time below the Mason-Dixon line. I'm just saying, to lay down that Southern accent as thick as he did at that home basketball game, probably not the best look, not the best first impression, but hey, he's their $95 million head coach, so he's going to be down there for a really long time.
I mean, if you pay me $95 million, I'll have any accent you want. I won't do it well. I really bad at accents.
I hear you on that. Accent for sale for Amber Wilson. Okay, we're going to keep this thing pushing. The Phoenix Suns face off against the Golden State Warriors, and they're trying to extend their 18-game win streak tonight on ESPN. Now, you might remember these two teams faced off earlier this week on Tuesday with the Suns besting the Golden State Warriors. So, Amber, what can we expect in this one? It's going to be in San Francisco. It's not in the Valley this time around. So I got to think the Warriors are going to be looking for a little bit of get back in this game.
Well, the Warriors have been looking back for get back for everybody this season. I think the Warriors are the most surprising story in the NBA this season. It's been remarkable that the Warriors somehow picked up right where they left off 5 years ago. I mean, I've never seen that. And then they did it without Klay Thompson. And the reports are that now Klay's only a matter of weeks from returning. So what's this Warriors team going to look like? I don't know what he's going to look like, frankly. We haven't seen him play since 2019. But what's this Warriors team going to look like if they can get any semblance of help from Klay Thompson? This is a scarier Warriors team, obviously. A huge credit to Steph Curry with what he's been able to do. It's a remarkable story, but a very good Phoenix Suns team as well. We know that story very well from last season and what CP3 was able to do with his leadership there with Booker and Ayton. This matchup should be a lot of fun.
Most likely to get back to the finals for you, the Phoenix Suns or the Golden State Warriors?
I mean, I guess I'm still going to ride with the Phoenix Suns because I'm so shocked with the Warriors that I don't understand how they're like, it's just been weird. I'm like, wait, what did I just transport to 2016? What happened here? You know? So I guess I'll still say the Suns because I've seen them do it more recently.
Gotcha. I'm with you. I would probably lean toward the Golden State Warriors just because I know that team has reinforcements coming a little bit later on this season. They've got Klay Thompson and James Wiseman coming back at some point. And that's just going to make them even more scary. So I don't know. I'm leaning with the Golden State Warriors on that one. But Amber, to round out three and out, we've got a truly heroic story coming out of the state of Michigan. The Michigan Wolverines football team is going to wear a jersey patch honoring Oxford High School shooting victims. The shooting occurred on Tuesday when a 15-year-old student at Oxford High School shot and killed 4 students and injured 7 others, including a teacher. To pay tribute to those victims and the local community, Michigan will wear a patch in the shape of a block O to represent Oxford and will feature the initials TM and the number 42 with 4 blue hearts below it. The TM 42 pays tribute to Tate Meyer, a sophomore football player at Oxford who was one of the 4 students who were killed, the other 3 victims being honored through the 4 hearts on the patch are Hannah St. Juliana, a basketball player and a volleyball player, Madison Baldwin, an aspiring artist, and Justin Schilling, a member of the bowling and golf team. So shout out to Michigan for doing that and honoring true heroes, Tate Meyer, and the heroics that he showed in the face of deadly circumstances, being able to stand up for his classmates. Can't say enough about his heroism under those circumstances. So that'll do it for us. Amber Wilson filling in for Mike Golic Jr. This is Chris Candy. You're listening to Candy and Golic Jr. ESPN Radio.